Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is in the interest of LS, CS, and JS, and SOB appellant and JS and CS respondents. For the appellant mother, we have Stephen Banger, attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee state, we have Brent Kempina, assistant attorney general from Pierre. You may proceed, Mr. Banger, and you have 20 minutes. Oh, before you start, the court should know that Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself. And the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's stead. So, Mr. Banger, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the members of the court, counsel. My name is Steve Banger from Sioux Falls. I'm the court-appointed attorney for the mother of three children who were taken into the custody of the Department of Social Services, not on one occasion, but actually on two formal occasions. She originally lived in Lincoln County. Later, she moved to Minnehaha County. Her children have been taken into the custody of the Department of Social Services first in the spring of 2002, and again, as a matter of formality anyway, on March 2nd of 2004. I submit to the members of this court that this case is all about what I view and submit constituted a classic example of calculated forum shopping by the Department of Social Services. As an attorney who's done a fair amount of trial work, I've had my experience of winning my share of cases and losing my share of cases. I've certainly had cases where the judge ruled against my position, or I lost a hearing, or I did not prevail in court. And I walked out of the courtroom, I was unhappy, I was disappointed. And I thought to myself, if I'd had a different judge listening to my case, or if I could have another opportunity to present my case, or if I could have another try at it, I'll bet the result would have been different. In this particular case, and any attorney who does not succeed in court, it's only natural for any attorney to have that kind of an attitude. I had the wrong judge. I wish I'd had a different court. I wish something about my first experience would have been different. But that type of thinking is barred in our system of jurisprudence by the fundamental principle of res judicata, which simply says all court actions must have a certain form of finality. This applies to all parties, all litigants. No party is excepted from this rule. And the elements of res judicata, of course, are well known to this court and have been well established over the years in a number of different decisions. If the parties have had a final judgment entered, and if the cases involve the very same question and the very same parties, and if those parties had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issues that were before them, a party does not have the right to have a second bite of the apple and to come back as what happened in this case, when the Department of Social Services, after losing their first case in Lincoln County, South Dakota, the very next day initiated a new case involving the very same issues and, as it turned out to be, the very same facts. An issue which could have been properly raised according to this court's holdings and determined in a prior action, even if it wasn't officially decided, is barred from a future attempt by a litigant to raise the issue again.
When did the mother move from Lincoln County to Minnehaha County in relation to the date of the final order of dismissal?
In all honesty, I don't know the exact date, but it was, I mean, the initial case started in the spring of 2002. It was on January 30, 2004 that Judge Caldwell orally ruled that she would be dismissing their case a month in the future, and by that time, the mother had already moved from Lincoln County to Minnehaha County. So she was a resident of Minnehaha County by March 2 of 2004 when the department decided to bring another action. There's one official pronouncement of this court that I think directly applies to this case, and that's where the court stated in Winterstein versus Benning that a party could have raised an issue but failed to do so will not prevent the application of res judicata. When a party fails to develop all of the issues and evidence available, that party is not justified in later trying the omitted issues in a second action based on the same claim.
Do you see a distinction between adjudicatory facts and dispositional facts? There's the fact here that the mother had allowed one of her children to come in contact with her husband or ex-husband was as I understand, going to be used purely as a dispositional fact to have the judge reconsider the disposition. It wasn't going to be used as an adjudicatory fact by Judge Caldwell. Is there a distinction?
As we've submitted in our brief, there is no distinction. If it is a distinction, it's completely without any legal effect or any legal meaning, because the whole purpose of our system is to develop all the facts in front of the judge that has control of the case and to allow that judge to know everything that happened in order to reach the proper decision. What purpose is served by, as we know from this case, cases sometimes drag out for a long time, in this case almost 2 years. Every single time a new incident that might have occurred that might technically give rise to an adjudication, does our system mean that the department should start a second case, a third case, a fourth case, and pretty soon we have multiple cases pending? Our whole system argues against that.
Well, let's take another kind of juvenile proceeding. Let's suppose it's a delinquency proceeding which has the same process, adjudication then disposition. And let's suppose a child is adjudicated on a shoplifting charge. Okay, there's a dispositional period of 6 months, the child's on probation, and now the child commits another shoplifting. So the probation officer goes to the judge and says, I want to bring him back. The judge says, no, I'm not, I don't want to take it. I refuse it, or whatever. I mean, are you saying then that because that adjudication is later dismissed, that the second shoplifting can't be prosecuted in a new delinquency action?
No, I'm not. But in the matter of a criminal offense, each separate act is an act that's viewed in and of itself. And a new offense would constitute a new case.
But why isn't this last fact that didn't go to the judge, why is that not a separate adjudicatory fact?
Because under the concept or the matter of the way an abuse and neglect case is handled by the circuit court, we should not be filing new and separate cases, because what we're dealing with here is not the factual issue of whether a criminal offense might have been committed by a juvenile, but what is in the best interest of the children, and without having protracted litigation such as exactly what occurred in this case, where each time a new incident might arise, we take them into custody again, we litigate again for months at a time, and in the meantime, as both parties have complained about, the children remain in limbo. They remain in foster care. For example, in this case, they were in 8 or 9 different foster homes over a period of roughly 3 years.
Is there any difference, using Justice Kornkamp's example, in a proceeding like this where we've said repeatedly the courts have continuing jurisdiction until the children reach 18? Because that normally doesn't apply to an ordinary civil action. Does that change the equation?
I believe it does. And that's the reason why, when new evidence is developed, or if some new incident happens, whether it's that the department considers to be serious, that information must be presented to the judge that has control and jurisdiction of the case at the time. Otherwise, we could have what did happen in this case, a situation where a judge has available to her all of the available facts on the case, makes a final decision, enters a final judgment, and the department just starts all over again with a new case the very next day.
Help me understand, just because I'm not sure exactly what you're trying to tell us. Under the facts of this case, are you saying that there's nothing that mother could have done subsequent to that day that would have justified initiating a new ANN petition? You're not saying that, are you? Are you saying that by this one incident having been dismissed, there can never be any conduct on the part of mother which would justify bringing another ANN petition? Help me understand what you're saying.
I cannot see why our system benefits our system is designed to benefit and to focus on what's in the best interest and welfare of the children.
I understand. Okay. And I'm sorry for the interruption, but you have an ANN petition filed for neglect where a mother has just left the kids alone for, let's say, 2-3 days. That is dismissed. 6 months later develops that it was happening where she was leaving them for a week at a time, letting a sexual predator babysit them, yada, yada, yada. You're saying that that's res judicata and a new petition can't be filed? You're not telling us that, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
But in that case, under those circumstances, the court that was in charge of the first case has already concluded its jurisdiction, has made a final decision.
Okay.
And why that becomes especially important here is where the department tries to file one and then a second and then argue that we have a first strike, a second strike, and then, as I'll get to at a later time in my argument, they used the two strikes as a justification to avoid reasonable efforts. But once a circuit court has jurisdiction of a matter involving the welfare of children, that jurisdiction, I submit, is continuing and must be all-encompassing. Otherwise, we'd have multiple cases pending at any one time, and the department could do what I submit they did in this case. When they developed new information while the first judge still had jurisdiction of the case, yet they knew they had lost their case, she had ruled that their evidence was not convincing and that it was not sufficient to justify termination of parental rights. They could wait until her decision lapsed and then file a new case in front of a second judge.
But that's not exactly what happened. As I read Finding of Fact 18, you presented this argument to Judge Lieberman, and he essentially said that the state's attorney tried to bring this evidence before the judge, and the judge wouldn't hear it. And if that's true, one of the cardinal elements of res judicata is a full and fair opportunity to litigate a second incident. It doesn't appear to me that under Judge Lieberman's findings that ever occurred here.
We have argued in the briefs, and I would maintain that position, that there was no, and the transcript of the hearing shows that there was no testimony given as to what the judge said to the prosecuting attorney during this unrecorded phone call. A timely hearsay objection was entered, and the witness, who happened to be the prosecuting attorney on the first case, never did testify as to exactly what he was told by Judge Caldwell. Instead, he simply testified, well, I got the impression that it would have been fruitless.
Well, he did attempt to litigate it, did he not?
I submit he did not, because
he filed a motion.
He filed a motion, but he did not schedule a hearing. And he admitted at the hearing that he could have. His exact words were, I could have forced the issue and scheduled a hearing. But he made a calculated decision not to, based upon something that he was told on the phone, which is not clear from the record. There is nothing in the record where Judge Caldwell refused to conduct a hearing, where Judge Caldwell said, I have no jurisdiction. The record does not support any such finding. There's nothing in the record that would say that that's what she ever said to the prosecuting attorney. Instead, the prosecuting attorney, we submit, realized that he wasn't going to win. It was not going to change her mind. But on the other hand, it could create endless speculation as to just what did she really say to him during a phone call that was not made on the record in the first place. So when an attorney files a motion, I'm not too, I mean, technically, it's true. A circuit judge can refuse to conduct a hearing on a particular motion. It's not necessarily very common. But at the same time, I would assume that the attorney that filed that motion could have scheduled a hearing. And there's nothing in the record that suggests Judge Caldwell would have refused to conduct a hearing. Instead, she said things to him during this unrecorded conversation that convinced him that the effort would have been fruitless.
What are the implications now of if we rule in your client's favor, does she get the children back then? That would be the result here?
The mother?
Yes.
Whether it would mean that the second action and the actions of Judge Lieberman would, and his findings and his conclusions would be vacated and reversed and would be of no legal effect.
The mother would be, the previous order dismissing it would be the one that would be in effect, and should that custody would have to be returned to her.
Whether the department could attempt to convince the first judge, Judge Caldwell, that she still had jurisdiction over the matter, which they did argue was true in their briefs, is something that I, in all candor, don't know.
What we have is Judge Caldwell's order of dismissal. So if that seems pretty final to me. Is that in the best interest of the children to return them to the mother?
Under the facts and under the circumstances of this particular case, I would submit that it is.
The record in this case, that even though she's her daughters, or at least one of them, has been molested by this man, and she has continued to expose children to this man, and then told Judge Lieberman that she doesn't think that he poses any danger whatsoever. You still think that's in the children's best interest?
The record shows that the mother has a very deep love and devotion to her children and has a significant bond to them. She never got, as to the issue of her relationship with the offender, which had been a long-standing one. In fact, as we know, she ended up marrying the man. She was extremely conflicted when she was told at one point, and we must also remember that when she heard through a third party that he had committed an act of abuse, she is the one that reported it to the authorities. But at that point, an investigation was initiated, but it lasted months. No criminal charges were filed for roughly 4 or 5 months. In the meantime, he was telling her, well, I didn't do that. I didn't do anything.
Well, now she's convinced that he didn't.
But after she received the appropriate counseling, according to the testimony of Dr. Larson, which was not disputed by the department, her mind opened up, and she realized that what he had done was extremely damaging to her children. And at the final hearing, she had been divorced from him. She testified, I want nothing to do with that man anymore. Even after he got out of jail, they did not cohabitate. He did not move back in with her, and she has discontinued her relationship with him. And she should have gotten more help in dealing with that issue. And the department, yet prior to June of 2003, the department refused to give her any help. There was no counseling, as the expert's testimony at the hearing showed. She was a victim, too, of what he did. And yet she was receiving all sorts of conflicting information.
I mean, Judge Lieberman didn't agree with this. I mean, apparently he concluded that the mother did pose a danger to her daughters. Is that right, or am I misreading the record?
I would answer that by saying that he thought that the mother still had some continuing problems. But in our view, as we've submitted in the briefs, the issue of whether reasonable efforts could have been made, should have been made, and would have been successful was not properly decided. And that's why we've asked this court to reverse that whole
thing. Suppose that we feel that Judge Lieberman's decision, regardless of whether the res judicata applies at this point, that we conclude that his decision is not clearly erroneous. And so there's a continuing concern about the safety of these children. I notice in your brief that you don't cite any res judicata case involving abuse and neglect All your res judicata cases deal with property or child support or something. You know, res judicata is a judge-made rule. If it's made by judges, should judges not also create exceptions in the case of children where children may be in danger?
I would submit the answer to that question is a definite no, because the concept of res judicata does not change from case to case or simply because children might be involved. In fact, very possibly the reverse. The children also have an interest in finality. Otherwise, we could have what happened here, where the children are kept in limbo for now. It's been 3.5 years that they're still in foster care. The courts need to make a final decision, and it should be done the right way, which does not mean, as I stated in the very beginning of my argument, that one party, perhaps the Department of Social Services, is accepted from the doctrine of res judicata, whereas no other party is.
So we have finality even? I mean, we're not talking here about a plot of land or a bank account. We're talking about children who may be in danger, and we're saying, well, you know what, we can't consider the fact that you're in danger because the law says you're entitled to finality. I mean, children are not static. Their situations change all the time. Shouldn't res judicata be looked at a little bit more skeptically when we're talking about children and their futures?
I would submit the answer to that question is no, because the concept remains the same. We need to be able to respect the ability of a circuit court judge to make the right decision, and not to allow a party to second guess that or to pull an end run on her decision, which is what I submit the department did in this case, and to excuse that by saying, well, we're talking about the welfare of children. I realize children are not an item of property, but at the same time, our system, which respects the control, the jurisdiction, and the ability of a circuit court judge to make the right decision the first time, does not change. And if the department thinks that that decision is wrong, they have the right to appeal to the Supreme Court, as any other litigant does and should.
Your time is up.
I have one question. Okay. And the time for appeal from Judge Caldwell's order of dismissal has now passed and has expired, so nothing would prevent the Department of Social Services from bringing a new action based on, based on the old action or the facts that occurred since the time of the order of dismissal, as to whether or not she should have custody of those children or she should have control of those children.
Nothing would prevent them from bringing a third case?
No, a second case. If Judge Lieberman had no jurisdiction, if he had no subject matter jurisdiction because the state should have appealed from Judge Caldwell's order of dismissal, that time has now run, so nothing would prevent them from now bringing an action as to whether or not she should have control and custody of those kids.
Whether Judge Caldwell might still have any continuing jurisdiction, because the motion was never resolved, is something that I honestly don't know.
Well, but how could she have continuing jurisdiction now after the time for appeal has run?
There's a very good reason to believe that the answer to that would be no.
Right. I mean, okay, that's over with. So now nothing prevents DSS, based on new conditions, from bringing a new action, whether you call it the second or the third or the hundredth.
Well, of course they did in front of Judge Lieberman. Now, if there was some incident that post-dated all of these other events that caused them to believe.
Right. What if something happened yesterday or the day before or something? Nothing prevents them from bringing an action.
That's correct. If the mother, from this day forward or perhaps from the date of the final judgment forward, went out and actually reestablished a relationship with the offender, the department could step in again. And I would make no argument then that they wouldn't have the right to do so in the best interest of the children. Her conduct is still subject to scrutiny in the future. It's not like a reversal in this case would mean that she's just free and clear to do anything she wants. She still must behave as an appropriate parent should.
Thank you, your time has expired.
Mr. Kempema, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. With the court's permission, I think what I would like to do is start off, as Mr. Binger did, and talk about the race judicata issue. I see that is most likely where this case is heading. When we're talking about race judicata, as the department has submitted in its brief, I believe the most important thing we need to do is define what the issues are in each of the two cases. I would submit to this court that in the Lincoln County case, the issue presented, or which potentially could have been presented to Judge Caldwell, is different than that which could have been presented in Minnehaha County. The issue in front of Judge Caldwell would have been essentially what effect the February 12, 2004 incident would have had upon disposition. The issue presented to Judge Lieberman, however, was the February 12th act an act of abuse or neglect? The issues are different, and as this court is well aware, that is one of the elements of race judicata of which mother must meet all.
Do you agree that race judicata bars all issues that were brought and all issues that could have been brought?
I would submit yes, if they truly could have been brought, providing the rest of the elements, of course, of res judicata.
Of course, the cases say exactly that. They don't say if they truly could have. They don't put that condition on it, do they?
That is correct.
Okay.
But I would submit to this court that in this particular case, that issue could not have been brought up to Judge Caldwell in Lincoln County. In fact, when the trial was held, the dispositional trial was held in Lincoln County, the final day of that trial was in actuality January 30th of 2004. And of course, the February 12th incident would have postdated that trial.
What about the doctrine the court has continuing jurisdiction over these children? Does that change the equation? Mr. Binger thinks it does.
In this particular case, I don't believe so. Judge Caldwell had made her decision on January 30th. There was a bit of an anomaly in abuse and neglect proceedings in the way that dispositional order was handled. Judge Caldwell essentially gave the fathers 30 days to file for custody of the children, to clean up those matters before the court would leave these children in limbo, essentially, for 30 days. So the order actually was not entered for 30 days. So I would submit to the court that, I mean, this case is somewhat of an anomaly. And should really be treated as such. Judge Caldwell, after the January 30th incident, what had happened is after mother commits this new abuseful or neglectful act, the Lincoln County State's Attorney did file a motion to reconsider. I'm sure this court is aware that the state or a party is not entitled as a matter of law to have a motion to reconsider heard. And for whatever reason, I think the record is clear that that hearing was not held. The court would not hold it. I know Mr. Woolman had said he could have forced the issue, but I don't believe as a matter of law he could have. And a motion to reconsider is not an appealable order, or denial of a motion to reconsider is not appealable. So essentially the state now is stuck in a situation in which children are being exposed to a sexual predator, and faced, and the state would be faced with the argument, well, is this really race judicata or is not? I do not believe that is in the best interest of the children. Judge Caldwell, by declining the motion to reconsider, which essentially by not ruling on it, she has declined the state's attorney's motion.
Do we even know that she saw that order?
Do we know that she saw the motion?
Well, we know that was, you know, we know that, I'm sorry, we know that the motion was filed, but do we know that it was ever presented?
I believe at least the inference from the record is yes, because it was Judge Caldwell who initiated the telephone conversation to the state's attorney. I honestly have reviewed Mr. Woolman's testimony and the testimony of the child's attorney, but I can't remember off the top of my head if that was actually said, but I know the inference is that Judge Caldwell did initiate the conversation with the Lincoln County State's attorney.
And you concede that the testimony is right, that Tom Woolman said it wasn't that he couldn't bring it, that he did bring it, but he didn't schedule a hearing because he thought it would have been fruitless on the merits.
I don't know about fruitless on the merits.
Well, he said fruitless, didn't he?
He did use the word fruitless. My understanding
now, that goes to the merits, doesn't it?
It goes to the jurisdictional issue, I believe it is what Mr. Woolman was talking
about. No, it means he means it wouldn't have done any good. He wouldn't have won, so he didn't think it was worth it. That goes to the merits, doesn't it?
If that's the interpretation that this court has of that particular testimony, yes.
Let's put the shoe on the other foot for a minute. Let's assume that Judge Caldwell had decided that she confirmed the abuse and neglect that had been ruled by then-judge, now Justice Meyer Henry, and she concluded that there would be termination of the parental rights of the mother. And she signed an order on the same date. Could the defense have gone into court the next day and commenced an action to vacate that order and to have the children be given back to the mother?
Absolutely not.
Right.
And I would submit to the court that has not happened in this particular case. In this particular case...
Well, if the defense can't do it, if the mother has no right to do that, why does the state have a right to do it?
I would submit that the state was, in this particular case, was acting on the best interests of the children. And you add to that, there was a new fact. Something else had happened. A new abuseful or neglectful act had happened after Judge Caldwell had orally rendered her decision.
Do you agree with the writing of this court that says that the oral decision means nothing until it's reduced to writing, because a judge can change her mind, his or her mind at any time?
That is correct.
Okay. So then why do you refer to the oral decision and not the written decision?
I refer to the oral decision because, as I stated earlier, it's a bit of an anomaly what had happened here. The Judge Caldwell had intentionally not signed that order for a specific and limited reason, to allow the fathers of these children to file for custody. I think the record is relatively clear from that January 30th, 04 dispositional hearing, that's what was going on.
This is going to sound like a strange question. Maybe it's another senior moment I'm having. The jurisdiction goes to the circuit court or to the individual judge, bearing in mind that both of these judges are co-equal and judges of the same circuit. Does that make a difference, or does the jurisdiction stick with the original judge as a representative of the court, foreclosing any action by another judge of concurrent jurisdiction in the same circuit?
That is an interesting question, and honestly, I was not prepared for it, but I would submit that the jurisdiction would remain within the circuit, or at least the county.
For the individual judge or for all of the judges within the circuit?
I would submit that it would be all of the judges. We have justices retiring frequently, and they don't retain their caseloads post-retirement. It's typically assigned to another judge within the circuit who would have concurrent jurisdiction.
That's kind of an invitation to judge shopping, isn't it? If you have one judge already on a case and you're shopping it around to everybody else.
Well, I would submit that the circuit court judges are typically pretty good about not allowing that to happen. There are cases where emergencies do arise wherein a judge is unavailable for whatever reason, in which another judge has to hear an emergency motion.
Is there any allegation here Judge Caldwell was not capable of continuing?
No, Your Honor. I think the indications are, I mean, this was a separate county, and it's my understanding, at least at that time, Judge Caldwell was handling Lincoln County cases, and Minnehaha County at that time rotates judges on abuse and neglect cases, but typically the judges stayed the same within the county. And I would submit that this was an entirely new case and should have been treated as such, and as such was assigned a new judge. As far as, you know, forum shopping, I don't think that's what was going on here. There was a new Abuseful and Neglectful Act, which needed to be dealt with in the best interest of these children. The department, in this particular case, after the motion to reconsider was essentially denied, and the Judge Caldwell, resting on her previous decision, saw a new Abuseful and Neglectful Act, filed a new abuse and neglect petition, and had that petition heard on its merits. I guess in closing on the res judicata argument, I would submit that the department never had a full and fair opportunity to present the essential issue in Lincoln County. The state's attorney did file his motion to reconsider. That motion to reconsider was essentially denied since Judge Caldwell did not rule on it or refused to rule on it or hear evidence.
You say that though, you say he didn't have a full and fair opportunity, but Mr. Wollman conceded that he could have had a hearing. How can we now say that when he declines to have a hearing, that he didn't have a full and fair opportunity?
I would submit that as a matter of law, Mr. Wollman may have been incorrect in that I do not believe under South Dakota law, he is entitled to a motion to reconsider.
So you're not, I mean, you're, this is your witness. This is the state's assistant state's attorney. And you're disagreeing with his assessment when he says, I could have had a hearing. You're saying, no, he couldn't. As a matter of law. How do you make that determination?
I believe it's discretionary whether a judge will hear a motion to reconsider. And I would submit that that's not in the declining a motion to reconsider is not an appealable order.
Did he testify that Judge Caldwell refused to hold a hearing?
He did not testify to that. His testimony, I believe, was that Judge Caldwell would not hold the hearing, and it would have been fruitless for him to push that issue. And when he says that it was fruitless to to push that issue. I essentially took that to mean is that the Judge Caldwell was going to refuse to consider the motion to reconsider.
Doesn't mean that he got the impression that even if he had a hearing, he wouldn't prevail.
That's correct.
Well, that's a different
thing. On the jurisdictional issue, because, I mean, the testimony that I took out of Mr. Wollman was that he felt that Judge Caldwell did not believe she had jurisdiction, and she would not hear the case because there was a new act in a new county. As far as the other issues raised by Mother in her brief, I'd like to touch on them just briefly, if I may. I would like to address essentially the next element is whether the children were properly adjudicated, abused, and neglected in the Minnehaha County case. In support of Mother's argument, she points out that the trial court's use of the prior adjudication in some way double counted other acts, the Lincoln County materials. I think the record is fairly clear, and Judge Lieberman, in fact, on the record stated what he was using the Lincoln County incidents for, and that's purely to put in context what is going on with this family, and that is entirely permissible under our law, and as the state points out in its brief, what we had going on here was a mother who continually subjected herself, her children, to a sexual predator. And I think in order for Judge Lieberman to fully appreciate what was going on, some of the acts from Lincoln County needed to be addressed.
So I'd like to know, how were they addressed? Did he simply take judicial notice of what had already been adjudicated in Lincoln County, or did he take new evidence and hear testimony about it and make his own determination about those events?
There was some testimony, but both parties requested that Judge Lieberman take judicial notice of the Lincoln County findings. In fact, the entire Lincoln County file. So yes, I mean, he essentially used both. There was some testimony, I believe, at adjudication as to what had gone on in the past. So Judge Lieberman did use both.
Did he make new findings about those facts, or did he simply accept the findings that were made in the previous?
He accepted the findings that were made on the previous. If you will notice that, and I believe in Mother's brief she points this out as well, a lot of the findings that Judge Lieberman puts in his adjudicatory findings are identical to the findings in the Lincoln County case, with the addition, of course, of the February incidents that happened after.
So he did not make new findings about the previous petition. He made about the events leading up to the previous petition.
That is correct. He did not make new findings. Those issues essentially would have been raised judicata because they had been litigated by both parties. Mother's next argument, and I see I'm running out of time here, is that the trial court erred in the state granting the state's motion for no reasonable efforts. Once again, Mother raises the argument that somehow the state is double counting these past acts. I would submit to the court that this is not an incident where we're double counting past acts to come to what Mother calls the two-strike rule. This is a case in which I use the analogy in the state's brief, a parent who has either a drug or alcohol problem. We're seeing that more and more in our courts. If a mother or father who has a drug or alcohol problem cleans up for a short period of time after abusing and neglecting their children in using those drugs or alcohol, cleans up for a short period of time, that case is dismissed because the parents clean their act up. if that parent were to again start using drugs and alcohol and committing additional abusive and neglectful acts, I do not believe that the state should be barred from using those acts just because they're similar in nature. We have essentially new acts. Even though the acts are similar in nature, they are different because, I mean, they're occurring at different times after receiving different results.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Binger, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The attorney for the department has discussed the issue of Judge Caldwell's continuing jurisdiction and whether she ever expressed that she had jurisdiction or that she did not have a jurisdiction. This is a matter that, number one, I respond to that by citing to the transcript, which never says and never attributes any comment to her to the effect that I have no jurisdiction. My decision was final on January 30. In fact, if this issue had been litigated, we know from the prior rulings of this court that her oral pronouncement on January 30 was not the final judgment, and it did not become so until it was reduced to writing and filed.
Help me recall, did she condition that oral pronouncement, as somebody indicated, to give the fathers an opportunity to involve?
She did make a comment to that.
Was it your perception that her oral pronouncement terminated the situation as it related to the merits, but she gave the extension for other reasons? Am I misreading the record on that?
Not necessarily. She did grant additional time in case someone else wished to make a motion for custody, but at the same time, she also said, I will not make a final decision until March 1, absent any other orders being entered in the meantime. So as a matter of law, she retained jurisdiction, and her jurisdiction was exclusive until such time as she filed a final order on March 1.
Thank you.
When the department's attorney argues that his own witness was incorrect when he said that she thought that she expressed to him or that he got the impression that any effort would have been fruitless, my response to that must be that no party has the right to argue a better version of the facts than what was expressed in court through your own testimony. And in this case, the prosecuting attorney who handled that case, who filed that motion, who had that conversation with the judge, clearly stated that he could have forced the issue, and as a matter of law, it's clear that he could have. He could have scheduled a hearing, he could have asked for an on-the-record decision by the court, he could have litigated the issue of jurisdiction if there was ever any controversy about it. There is nothing in this record that says that Judge Caldwell ever expressed to anyone that she would not hold a hearing. Instead, she apparently made a comment that convinced the attorney, Mr. Wollman, that any such effort to litigate this evidence, this new evidence that he thought he had, would be fruitless. And so it is beyond, anything beyond that is just a matter of not only speculation, but almost double speculation as to whether she would have changed her mind, because I submit that's what this is really about. The state was disappointed in her decision. They hoped they could convince her to change her mind. They talked to her on the phone, and something must have been said that convinced them that it wasn't going to work. But the record, I submit, is clear that if the department thought that the incident which occurred on February 12 was so serious that it required emergency action in the best interest of the children, why did they wait until March 2nd before they filed any official action regarding it? It's because the department knew that only Judge Caldwell had jurisdiction over the case at that point. Why else would they wait? And yet, that's exactly what they did, and by doing so, They were able to manipulate the proceedings so that they could get a second chance in front of a second judge. And the parties in the case like this can argue endlessly as to what the right decision of a court should be. But no party has the right to say, well, I lost in front of this judge, so I'll wait until she's done, and then I'll take a second chance at it, even though I already brought all of this evidence to her attention. So the department has repeatedly taken the position that the February 12 incident was extremely serious, but why did they wait? It was a tactical decision, because they knew that she wasn't going to change her mind. And if the issue of her jurisdiction had been litigated as a matter of law, there's no question but that she and only she had jurisdiction over the case. You can't have two judges having A&N proceedings pending against the same family at the same time. Continuing jurisdiction means exactly that. One court, one continuing jurisdiction, and you can't just decide to take your case to wait until the first judge is done and then file a second case and hope to get a different result. And yet, I submit that's exactly what did happen in this case. What really happened is that the department filed a motion and then they abandoned the attempt. They could have scheduled a hearing, but they made an elective decision to abandon that motion. And they also abandoned their right to appeal her decision. These are fundamental decisions that a party has the might or the right to make, but this court has stated in its previous rulings that if you choose to make that decision, you are bound by it. And you don't have the right to just make a tactical decision to try to get a second bite of the apple. And yet that's exactly what the department did. They had every opportunity to litigate this issue, but they chose not to do so. During my first presentation, I'm sorry that I didn't have enough time to discuss the issue of reasonable efforts. I imagine I'm now restricted to rebuttal of any comments that were made by the opposing counsel on this issue.
Pretty much.
But I would submit this. Even if the court feels that the res judicata argument is without merit, the Department of Social Services has a constitutional and statutory duty to provide services to a family to try to reunify them. This is based upon a parent's constitutional rights and based upon the general notion that it's always in the best interest of children to be with their natural and biological parents. No, the department, only in rare, compelling circumstances involving egregious cases, should the department be allowed to bypass these efforts. And yet, what the department did in this case was they, by filing the second case, they called the first one a first strike and the second one a second strike, and they continued with what they had done since June of 2003, and that is offer the family nothing by way of services. And yet this family needed help. They had all been the victims of an abuser, not just the children, but the mother too. And yet they adopted an antagonistic stance toward her. They refused to give her any help. And then they blamed her because she still had issues. And that's exactly what they did in front of Judge Lieberman, and it's what they've done during their briefs that they filed with this particular court. They did collaterally attack what Judge Caldwell had found during the first case by when she found that the mother had satisfied the case plan. It's clear from her statements on the record. Mom did everything she was asked to do. She satisfied the case plan. Yet during the second case, the department repeatedly presented witnesses to say, well, no, that really wasn't true. She didn't really do everything that we asked her to do back in 2002 and 2003. And that is a fundamental violation of the collateral estoppel doctrine, which is not the same, but has some similarities to the res judicata argument. This family could have, 2 years ago, this family could have been reunited if they had been offered the correct services. If mother had been given the teaching and the counseling to understand what this man had done, if she had been offered some help, her attitude about a lot of things might have very well been different. And the only expert who testified in this case clearly said so. And her testimony, I'm referring to Dr. Larson, was unrebutted by the state in this particular case. Witnesses on both sides agreed that it would have been a good idea to offer the family joint counseling where they could all get together and talk about what this man had done. Yet the department not only didn't offer her those services, they refused to let her do any of it on her own. How does all of this dovetail into what we know is the constitutional duty of the department to implement the least restrictive alternative? I submit that the department in this particular case committed itself to the exact opposite. They were committed to not reunify the family and to terminate the mother. And on December 12, 2003, their primary social worker testified in front of Judge Caldwell, "There is nothing that mother could ever do to change our mind."
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Ringer.
Based upon all of these, we ask the court to reverse the judgment.
Thank you. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.